forward seems too much. When you feel totally out of touch, hope is seeping out the door. You find yourself curled on the floor. Thoughts swirl round, all jumbled and messed. Why is this brain so darkly obsessed? I've secrets I've never confessed. Haven't told a soul. Gentle whisper through the pain. Remember rainbows follow rain. Breathe deeply, hold on tight. Your hope will return, shining bright. Embrace the now, release the past. In forgiveness, peace will last. You matter deeply. You're let your strength be shown.
Hello there.
Hello there.
It's so good to be back. I'm Elaine Lindsay. This is Suicide Zen Forgiveness. And I have a returning guest. I am very honored to be here today with Phil King. And we are at the start of Suicide Prevention Awareness Month. So I think it only fitting that I'm going to call you the king of mental health.
Yeah,
I'm going to get Frank to tell you a little bit about what he does. But first, I just want to say something. I think it's incredibly important that people know Frank has already done 13 TED Talks. 13. Okay. That's a big one and a three. And you can just go to TED and check that out. You have to have some really important messages, I think, to get past five, never mind 13. So yeah. I suggest you take every single drop of what Frank offers us today, because I am so honored to have you back with me.
You are so kind, and your audience should know that I really had no choice, Elaine, because this is part of a plea bargain arrangement, and they should know, okay, they should know also that I'm a comedian. I've been a comedian since the fourth grade. When I told my first joke, the kids laughed, the teacher was hysterical, and at 9 years old, I thought to myself, I'm going to be a comedian. And 12th grade talent show, nobody had ever done stand-up. I did it, I won. Of course, I beat the accordion player and the folk dancers. Not a tough victory, but a victory nonetheless. And then said to my mother, I'm going to be a comedian. I'm going to LA after high school. She goes, no, you're going to college first. I don't care what you do when you get done. You can be a goat herder for all I care, but you're going to be a goat herder with a college degree. So I went to UNC Chapel Hill, a couple of college degrees, and bolted for the West Coast. My first open mic night, April 1st, 1984. Halfway through my 5 minutes, I heard a voice inside my head that said, you're home. Decided at that moment I was going to do it for a living. Had no idea how. I've threatened for years to write a keynote called What Could You Do If You Didn't Know No Better? Because I had no idea how hard it was. 18 months later, said to my girlfriend, then my wife now of 38 years, I'm going on the road to be a comic full time. You want to come along for the ride? Figuring she'd go, oh, hell no. She said, yeah. So we gave up the apartment and our jobs and jumped into my tiny little Dodge Colt. And we were on the road for 2,629 nights in a row, nonstop. And worked with Seinfeld and Dennis Miller and Rosie and Ellen and Adam Sandler and Kevin James and opened up for Lou Rawls and Randy Travis, the Beach Boys. An amazing 10 years on the road. Then did some radio in my old hometown of Raleigh, North Carolina. 18 months, I took a number one morning show, drove it to number six. A friend of mine said, you didn't just drive it in the ground, you drove it in the middle earth. True. Then got into corporate comedy, which people ask, what's the difference between a corporate comic and a club comic? About $5,000 a night plus travel. So I did that for 10 years until the last recession, you know, the world financial collapse. And we lost everything at that point in Chapter 7 bankruptcy. And that's when I learned what the barrel of my gun tasted like. Spoiler alert, I did not pull the trigger. A friend of mine came to a keynote not long ago and he thought it'd be funny. He came up to me and goes, hey, man, how come you didn't pull the trigger? I said, hey, man, could you try to sound slightly less disappointed? He's a good friend. But anyway, after speaking came back, I'd always wanted to make a living and a difference. I just had no idea how. And meeting planner said to me, Frank, we love you. We just can't pay you that kind of money anymore. Just to be funny, you got to teach the audience something. So fortunately, I have a friend named Judy Carter. And Judy wrote a book called The Message of You, Turn Your Life into a Money-Making Speaking Career. And she gave me an Audible copy. And she goes, Frank, listen to this. You'll figure it out. And halfway through, I thought, I do have something to talk about. Given depression, suicide run in my family, more nuts in my family than in a squirrel turd, the fact that I have two mental illnesses, the fact that I came very close to killing myself, I thought I could keynote on suicide prevention as a workplace health and safety issue.
Yeah.
My second thought was, yeah, who's going to take me seriously after 2.5 decades of comedy? So my wife said, do a TEDx. And I said, what's a TEDx? Just so happened, I got an application that week from one in Vancouver, BC. And I filled it out, got the audition, got it. And then two more events called and said, do you have any more mental health topics? Oh, yes. So that's the first three. And then the rest, I've got 10 more, about one a year since 2014. And I speak on suicide prevention as a workplace. Yep. Yeah, I'm leaving for Pacific, Missouri. Didn't know there was a Pacific, Missouri, and next Monday, a week from today. Construction. Construction, by the way, in the U.S. has the highest rate of suicide of any industry. 1,000 people roughly die every year. Accident, 6,000 die by suicide.
Yeah.
You're six times more likely to jump off the building. I know. Yep. That's why they're my number one ideal client, because the problem is so bad.
Oh, wow. And yeah. I find it a little hard, you must as well, because all the stats we have are at least 2-3 years old. It's really hard to actually get stats on suicide.
And that's 2022, CDC 2022. 1,000 people in 2021 died by accident and construction, 6,000 died by suicide. But if you look back historically, that's about average for construction. Yeah. So I'm doing that one, and I'm doing the Texas roofers, again, construction in later in the month. And then there's I did a couple of presentations for the Washington State Patrol law enforcement.
Yeah.
And there was a woman there from a department where they watch all the body cam video that, you know, and catalog it for trial.
Yeah.
And many of them, if they're of an age, they didn't sign up for that. They would read reports back in the day, but to see that sort of whatever on video, giving CPR to an infant, or terribly disturbing. And so there's a great deal of stress and overwhelm and burnout. So I'm gonna do a talk on mental health and wellness in the workplace, as well as suicide prevention. So it's...
And it's sad that this is such a problem that we can talk about having to do this by industry.
Yes.
That is a terrifying thought.
But I know. Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, I know early on in COVID, what was shocking to me, by the end of 2021, one of the big industries became veterinarians.
And still is. Veterinarians, yeah. Physicians, analysts. And people ask, do you do the same keynote each time? Pretty much the same keynote, same learning objectives, same takeaways. The difference is the risk factors. The risk factors for veterinarians are different than the risk factors for people in construction. However, mm-hmm. veterinarians, physicians, dentists, and attorneys, suicide is a result, not the actual issue, because what the issue is, many of them come out of college in the U.S. with $500,000 in student loan debt before they open a practice. So there's financial stress, which leads to mental and physical stress, which leads to heart attack, stroke, depression, suicide. So they, those professionals, those practices, they have that in common very much. Whereas construction, it's deadlines, seasonal work, relatively low educated. Yeah. Plus they treat injuries, oftentimes opioids. So that's their risk factor.
Yeah. The pharmaceutical addiction is as high, if not higher, than street addiction. We just don't really talk
about it. And over 100,000 people die from opioid overdose every year in the U.S. And what we don't know is how many were suicides, how many were accidental overdoses. If there's no note, we really don't. And that's separate from the suicide statistics. When I started my first TEDx talk that year or the year before, 39,000 people died by suicide. Last year, I believe it was, or 2023, it was a little over 50,000 people. Another 11,000 added to the number in an 8-year stretch. So it's not getting better. It's getting worse.
No, and the opioid crisis in Canada is absolutely out of hand as well. And
that I didn't know.
Yeah, and I know that firsthand. I am a functional junkie. I am down to the least number of opioids one can possibly have, but it is required to keep me upright and functioning. And getting off the bucket full was not easy. It took almost 3 years, but I'm happy to say that I'm on the right side of it now.
I have, the way I'm wired physiologically, it turns out I'm allergic to opioids. If you give me anything that I'm throwing up like Lindsay Lohan after a 3-day weekend, and I tell providers that, I go, look, if you're going to give me opioids, I need the legal limit of Zofran, which is an antiemetic. Oh, we'll give you a little something to take the edge off. It's an edge, because I'm telling you. Yeah. So it's very fortunate that sort of painkiller I cannot tolerate. So,
well, I said early on that I'm very lucky. God, the universe, whomever, did not give me a taste for alcohol. I hate the taste of alcohol. Thank God.
Yeah.
Because I would have been one mean drunk.
Robert Williams said one time, I'm not addicted to cocaine. I just like the smell of it. Yeah, he also said cocaine is God's way of telling you you're making too much money.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, you really have to consider that when you think it's something that people like cigarettes. I was a smoker early on. I quit in 1988. And then cigarettes went up to almost $10 a pack. And at one point, I smoked 2.5 packs a day.
Hello.
And I thought, there's no way on God's green earth I am wasting $25 on cigarettes. I could be shopping. And that was it. Never had another one.
A cousin of mine, her sister just passed away and in her 80s, and she's cleaning out the house. And her sister was a smoker, Marlboros, and she found two cartons in a bag. And she goes, Frank, I looked at the receipt. It was over $200.
Yeah.
She goes, I think I'm going to include these in the estate sale.
Yeah. You know, she probably so makes money too.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. It is absolutely shocking to me the price of cigarettes. And we're on like very close to the American border. And we're also in an area where there were a number of reservations. So in the late 80s and 90s, when cigarettes got very pricey, there was a huge trade in illegal cigarettes running back and forth across the St. Lawrence River. I had quit by then, so I did not contribute, but I know a lot of people that did.
Yes, and I have sailed the St. Lawrence, actually.
I
worked on cruises as a comic starting in 2009, and one of the cruises I took was from Quebec, I think, down the St. Lawrence. They call them leaf peepers. It's as the leaves are changing.
Oh, yeah.
The St. Lawrence. Yeah. Oh, my God. And the St. Lawrence is not that wide. You almost feel like you're going to reach out and touch this church. Yeah. And the foliage, something else.
It is spectacular. I know that New Hampshire and Vermont is lovely in the fall, but it has nothing on Quebec. Oh, my God.
No.
The Gatineau Hills are just absolutely stunning. We came down the St. Lawrence partway on a freighter. We came to this country not on some fancy cruise ship. We came on a freighter. And luckily for me, I was about 3 years old. And the captain liked having a little somebody meandering around. Although my parents kept me in reins like a horse. They were afraid I was going over the side. And Granny, I'm so sorry that I'm going to tell this story. But just before we landed, my grandmother was sick over the side and lost her teeth. So when she got it wasn't a good scene for a couple of months because we basically came here with the clothes on our back. My mom and dad gave up all the furniture so that we could bring my grandmother and my aunt with us. So, forgive me, Gran. But, they all went out and worked so that we could get her some new teeth.
Yes.
Hey, we do what we have to do.
That is correct. Last time I talked about the chronic suicidal ideation.
Yes.
Which is rare. And I believe Elaine didn't realize that was what she had until I brought it up. And that has recurred in my career. Generally, at my keynote, at least one person in the audience has that. They have no idea it has a name. They think they're just some kind of freak and all alone. A young woman come up after a college presentation and said, thank you for your keynote. I said, you're welcome. She goes, but I got to tell you, it made me weep. How did it make you weep? She said, you know your story? I tell a story about chronic suicidal ideation means that for me and Elaine and people in our tribe, the option of suicide is always on the menu as a solution for problems large and small. And when I say small, my car broke down a couple of years ago. I had three thoughts unbidden. One, get it fixed. Two, buy a new one. Three, hell, I could just kill myself. So she says, you know your story about the car? Get it fixed, buy a new one, kill yourself? I go, yeah. She goes, I've been having those thoughts all my life. I had no idea that had a name. I thought I was just a freak, completely alone. And when I heard you say it out loud, you have it, it's a thing. I realized for the first time in my life, she said, I'm not alone. And I wept. That's the power of starting the conversation on suicide, is things like that. And so, but it does exist. It's not in the DSM-5. Hopefully it'll be in the DSM-6, Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of the Big Book of Psychiatric Diseases. But yeah, it's relatively rare. And it doesn't make sense to normies. What? No. Your car broke down, you can kill yourself? No, it's not a serious thought. I can finance another one. I'm not going to die over a bad radiator. And Elaine apparently didn't know that she'd been living with that her entire life.
It was the very first time you were on back in 2021 and you talked about it. And I can remember it was like, I was watching Price is Right. Ding, ding. There you got it. Like, oh my God. But as a child, you know how you just assume everybody thinks like that? I was, as a little kid, I had these horrific fevers. And for a long time, they didn't know what they were. And my parents ended up borrowing thermometers from everybody in the building. Now, luckily for my parents, there were only 12 apartments because I bit through every one of them. I didn't like those things. I was a bit of a brat. And I bit through them, and my parents had to take the grocery money and replace people's thermometers. But what happened, they would all traipse into our apartment with their ice cube trays, because the only way to get my fevers down was put me in an ice bath. Ooh. So very often for me, it was, let's see, get in the ice bath or jump off the balcony. I think I want to jump off the balcony. But it was always hard because they were forever pulling me back in the house. And like you said, it was for everything, like crazy things. By the time I was in grade 3 and I was stuck with this curly hair, I can remember one morning my hair was just so curly. And I'd been called Shirley Temple for the umpteenth time. And I thought I could just say I'm sick and stay home for school, or I could just end my life. Because that, to me, just, it was always on the table until I lost my friend at 16. And it came into very sharp focus what that meant to just end your life. And then it became a battle inside me. Because the other thing that happened early on, when I was 5 or 6, I saw the movie Pollyanna. With Hayley Mills and Pollyanna. Yeah, she, yes, all the guys thought she was great. Her dad taught her to play something called the glad game. You always found something to be glad about. So my ideation half and the glad game fought all the time. It was constant until Andrea died. And then things got Harry. But tell us more about our tribe, and what did you do to manage this?
Speaking, somebody asked me once, actually more than once, somebody more than once, does retelling your story on stage, because I tell my story on stage. My grandmother died by suicide. My mother found her. My great aunt died by suicide. My mother and I found her. I was 4 years old. I screamed for days. And so they said, does that trigger you to tell your story? I said, no, you know, it's the reverse of that. It's very therapeutic for me. Because the young woman who came up afterwards and had wept, she now, hopefully I was able to steer her far enough off the path to suicide, she would live a normal life. And I remember being in Montana, University of Montana. I'd done a college presentation. I'm standing outside the building and it's dusk, it's snowing, and I can hear a river not far away. So dusk, snowing, river. And the kid went to get his truck to take me back to the hotel. And with the river, the dark, the snow, I thought, and having people come up afterwards and tell me their story, share their story, I thought, oh my God, I'm like George Bailey and It's a Wonderful Life. I've been shown what these people's lives might be like if I weren't there simply to tell my story and hear theirs. And if I kill myself, I could, in theory, take a lot of these people with me who never had a chance to do that. So I'm stuck. And a friend of mine said, you can't live with that. I go, no, you missed the point. I can't die with that. I can't. So I find it very therapeutic. I mean, people tell me things that they generally haven't told anybody. I was doing a construction engagement, because construction has the highest rate of suicide in the U.S. as industries go. And it was on site, and there were 6 fellows lined up afterwards to chat, because I say, look, we'll do some general Q&A, and then when I'm done, if you have a story you want to share or question, don't want to share with everybody, I'll take them individually. So I go over, and there's 6 guys lined up, and the 6th guy in line, African-American gentleman, I'm guessing mid-20s, he's crying so hard he can't speak. So I waited. And he gathered himself. I said, what's up? He said, I haven't slept in 2 nights and I work on the 5th floor of this building and I think about jumping off every day. I said, why is that? He said, because I've lost 3 people in the last year to violence, including my daughter who died in my arms. How'd you like somebody to pull the pin on that grenade and drop it in your lap?
Oh, my God.
So the gentleman who hired me was the HR director. So I waved him over. I go, and I said, look, you need to go and find the EAP, the Employee Assistance Program binder. Find the nearest mental health facility to where we're standing right this minute and take this nice young man because he's circling the drain. A couple of months later, I had occasion to talk to the HR director, and I was terrified to ask. Finally got up my nerve. I go, whatever happened to that nice African-American fellow, Frank? He got evaluated, medicated. He's back on the job. And I'm guessing none of his workmates knew. Probably a lot of his family had no idea how close he was. So that I find very therapeutic. I did a military base, the National Training Base for the Army, and it's in California, just off the Interstate 10, Fort Irwin. It's Interstate 10. They go 30 miles up this road, and they call it the world's longest cul-de-sac. It ends at the base, and a third of the soldiers on that base, in an anonymous survey, had said they'd considered suicide in the last year. So they brought me in for obvious reasons, and I think I did two or three keynotes that day. They rotated the soldiers through, and I had met the base psychologist and did his podcast. And several months later, I got a DM on LinkedIn from him. He said, Frank, a soldier came into my office today and said, I'm depressed and suicidal, and I'm here because Frank King said I had to tell someone. So it's very therapeutic.
Yeah, so you
my can. Goal. I can't. My goal is to save a life a day. That's my goal. And I assume I've probably done better than that because you don't hear from everybody. Oh, yeah. But I assume hopefully I've done that or better.
You have reiterated the whole point of doing this podcast, because sharing your story lightens your burden. And if we can offer hope to one person, yeah, absolutely. And to me, that is so important, because I know, I see both sides. I see how you can be drawn to leave, and I see how you can be drawn to stay. And I've seen the results of all of that. I lost 6 people before I was 30 years old. Ouch. So it's, yeah. Yeah, it's a lot. And it doesn't stop. That's the aim.
Somebody may see this and have chronic suicidal ideation and has just realized, or watching us right now, that's a thing. Yeah, that's what I'm hoping of. I met a young woman. She and her mom both had it. And she thought everybody had it because the two of them had it.
Yes.
I think it was the same event. I finished my speech. I came out into the lobby, the foyer, and a woman got up and followed me out, and she was crying. And she, again, had no idea that it had a name. And she said, is there a medication for that? I said, there's medication for depression. I don't think there's any medication for chronic suicidal ideation. I said, here's the thing. Just because you have a thought doesn't mean you have to act on it. And as a junior psychologist, not without a degree, a freelance psychologist, I believe it's a coping mechanism for your brain. It's your brain saying, we can solve this problem. You're not going to like it, but we can solve this. So it's just a coping mechanism. And you mentioned hope. That's what I tell people. Look, I'm not a psychiatrist or a psychologist or a therapist. I'm just here to plant seeds of hope. I got busted once outside in the foyer after a talk by a psychologist. And he said, look, what qualifies you to talk about suicide prevention? You're not a psychologist. You're not a psychiatrist. You're not even a therapist. And I said, I can tell you what the barrel of my gun tastes like.
Yeah.
And Elaine, in the silence that followed, I said, look, Chief, I can go to college. I can learn everything you know, everything. You will never know everything I know.
That's right.
That's what qualifies me.
Yeah. I know the taste of charcoal, both ways.
Yeah, so psychologists have their place. Had a young woman come up to me. Yeah, come up to me after a show at a college, Wofford College, I think. And she said, can I give you a hug? Now, Elaine, this is right during the Me Too movement, the height of it. And everybody in the room's got a video camera in their phone. And she's going to hug me. And I could just see the headline in the paper. The speaker gropes co-ed.
So oh, God.
I leaned over, pushed my pelvis back as far as I could, and gave a very brotherly hug. And when we stopped hugging, I said, are you a hugger? She goes, no, I'm not a hugger. I go, well, what was that? She goes, I live with mental illness. I have a therapist I've been going to for 2 years, and she's well qualified. She's got the diplomas on the wall, but she has no context. She said, I'm sitting in the back of the room listening to you 15 minutes, and I'm thinking, this guy is inside my head. You did more for me in 45 minutes than she's done for me in 2 years. Because I have context, because I understand. I hear the same music she hears.
Yes. I'm going to take this a little off side for a minute, but I've been making this point now since the 70s. It is so important because, like us, who know what it is on all sides, for those who are first responders, for doctors, for nurses, for police, you have to be a patient for 24 to 48 hours, have all the various pokes and sticks and blood and what have you, so that you can have some empathy for that meat suit in front of you, because a lot of times that's how they treat people. And until you have context, you can't have full empathy.
Fortunately, here in Eugene and Springfield in the county, all the sheriffs and all the police officers are trained in CIT, crisis intervention training, where they are trained to, when they roll up on a situation, to determine if it's a crime or a crisis. Because in the past, we just take them to jail. That was just take them to jail. To now, is it a substance abuse disorder issue? They'll take them to the proper facility, male or female. They usually have separate facility. Or is it, in fact, a crime? And I met a guy who was, he took over the county medical system, health system, mental health system in the whatever county San Antonio, Texas is in. And they were getting ready to build another jail because it was busting at the seams with people who had mental illness. Because they just dumped them there regularly. So he had everybody trained in CIT. And within a year, and the department was in the red because of all that. Within a year and a half or so, they had decided not to build a new jail. As a matter of fact, they were renting out jail space to other counties because they were taking people who had mental challenges, substance abuse, whatever, to the proper facility, not just dumping them in the jail. So it's, yeah, but it takes something. You have to get the training. You have to understand.
Yes.
There was a guy, he gave an example of a guy, they rolled up on a situation. I think it was a Vietnam vet. And he was, you know, sure that the Viet Cong were after him and he's hunkered down behind something. He's got a weapon. One of the guys who was the police officer had been to Vietnam, an older guy. So he sidled up beside him and said, hey, brother, what is it? They're surrounding us. Yeah, I know. Listen, I can get us out of this. So he did that participatory therapy where you don't deny what they're seeing or feeling. You join them in there wherever they are. And sure enough, that was enough to get him to calm down and they got him to the proper facility. But it had to be somebody who had the CIT training and could relate to what the guy was going through in terms of war. Understood what the guy was seeing.
Yeah. And it's interesting because before we came on air, we were talking about my father and dementia. And I had said to you that we follow the British protocol from contented dementia. And it is about getting into their world. You follow the expert. The expert is the patient. They've never been in that world before, and you certainly haven't either. So follow them. And in a bigger respect, that makes so much sense.
Yes, because your human nature is to try to reorient them.
Yeah.
To what is real. Rather than do that, because that just frustrates them and they get But it's terribly frustrating. You're not in whatever, you're here. So it's, but yeah, I think it's called participatory therapy where you just join them. Where are you?
Yeah.
I'm in Greensboro.
And it's all follow your lead. I'll go where you are. But when you see, there's a lot of dementia around us. And when you see people constantly correcting someone, it's frustrating to be corrected over and over again. Doesn't matter whether you're right or not. It's just frustrating. And a gentleman, as we were leaving, we were at a doctor's appointment, an eye appointment for my dad. And we got into a sort of a rhythm. On Mondays, my father called Monday morning, and it was a very short conversation. No, there's no paper today. Yep, I know. No, they're charging the same amount, Dad. Yep. You know how they like to make money. The paper had stopped 3 years ago. And this was the Monday conversation. We're at the eye doctor. He was down to about 30 seconds of memory. So it was, why am I here? Who brought me to this doctor? Who called them? And that went over. And this gentleman, as we were leaving, he came up and he said, my God, you have a lot of patience. I said, actually, I don't. I just love my father.
Yeah.
And it was no skin off my nose. I was there whether or not I was answering the same questions. That didn't really matter. I love my father enough to do that. And I think we have to be able to love our neighbor, our homeless person, our person with a mental disorder as much as we love the rest of the people around us, because they're human too.
I have a friend who I believe has untreated schizoaffective disorder, and he was experiencing visual, auditory, and physical hallucinations. And he said, do you believe me? And I said, I believe that you believe that's happening. And that's all that's important. If you believe it's happening, rather than say, no, nobody's.
Yeah.
And I had the benefit, Elaine, my second heart surgery. I've had a valve job twice. Yeah. The second one, they gave me a scopolamine patch because of my nausea and opioids. And it must have been weapons grade, because I hallucinated. I saw 6 foot tall cartoon characters with whom I had Wile E. Coyote and Quick Draw McGraw and full blown conversation. My wife said I was operating an abacus in midair to the point where she said, look, if you don't stop hallucinating, they're not going to let you leave. So we took the patch off, but it took me a while to come down, but it gave me a great deal, because I would have gone to court and sworn on everything I'd seen when I was that high. It was that real to me. So I understand how, now I understand how when people see or hear, they truly, the brain is a powerful machine. So.
It certainly is. My God, it certainly is. Wow. I love that we've covered this, because you took me to a whole new place. And I think I might have said it, but not enough. Thank you very much for giving me another piece of the puzzle that is me. It's been an interesting puzzle to try and put together. There's still a couple of extra pieces, but what the hell?
It's comforting to find out it's a thing.
Yeah.
What you're experiencing is actually a thing. It has a name.
Yeah. I think that's probably the most important piece, that it has a name, meaning it's not just me, but it's not everybody. Mm-hmm. And it does take it down a notch from where you can overblow things in your own mind when you don't know anything. And I think there's an awful lot more to unpack. I think there's an awful lot more to unpack just with you, Frank, because there's always something else. You are an absolute font of brilliant information. And you are funny as hell. Every time I've seen you, and I have seen him in real life more than once, I think it's just incredible. I would like to ask you to come back, please. Absolutely. Sure. And on that note, what can you leave our audience with today? One little...
8 out of 10 people. Yes, this is what I leave my audiences with. 8 out of 10 people who are suicidal are ambivalent. They cannot make up their mind. 9 out of 10 give hints in the last week leading up to an attempt, which means you can make a difference. You can save a life. And you can do it by doing something as simple as what we're doing right here, and that is having a conversation. So it doesn't, you don't have to be a mental health professional to stop a suicide. You just have to care.
That is so good. I actually coined a new hashtag in the past, I think, month and a half. It is conversations. I want us all to start a conversation. Because when we think about it that way, we understand how important it can be.
And you can save somebody with something very simple, a smile. When you look them in the eye and you smile, there's, oh, you got a 3 o'clock. We're at the top of the hour. Oh, no. We'll just have to take this up later.
We'll be talking with other people.
Yes. Cliffhanger.
Cliffhanger. Yeah. Oh, this is wonderful that you're going to come back. I just think there's an awful lot more to explore. And I think that the more we talk about suicide, the more we talk about ideation, the more likely we are to have these conversations be part of the day-to-day instead of being held up on the high shelf for the difficult topics. I want it to be right there with everything else at the kitchen table, so that we can make sure we save every single one we can.
Next time we get together, because I've got a TEDx on this, the mental with benefits, the evolutionary advantages of mental illness. Let's talk about the upside
of mental illness. I like that. Okay. Title is then done for us. The upside of mental illness.
Yep.
You're on. Okay, I have made a note, so all we have to do now is book you in.
Yeah, send me a calendar link, we'll do it again.
Yeah. I cannot thank you enough. I will be talking to you soon, and I am excited that we're making some headway in this bigger conversations that we're having to help people out there. I want us to get to a place where we don't have to quantify the numbers by industry, because I want the numbers to be so small. I want them to be minimal. I want them to be nothing.
Yeah.
Agreed. Thank you, Frank. I so appreciate you coming. We will talk again soon. And in the meantime, make the very best of your today, every day. And we'll see you again next time. Yeah, we will definitely see you. I don't know what's going on with my recording here.
Thank you for being here for another inspiring episode of Suicide Zen Forgiveness. We appreciate you tuning in. Please subscribe and download on your favorite service and check out SZF's YouTube channel or Facebook community. If you have the chance to leave a 5-star rating or review, it'd be greatly appreciated. Please refer this to a friend you know who may benefit from the hope and inspiration from our guests. Suicide Zen Forgiveness was brought to you by the following sponsors. Trul Social Media, the digital integration specialists. Let them get you rocking page one in the search results. Canada's keynote humorist, Judy Kroon, motivational speaker, comedian, author, and stand-up coach at Second City. Judy has been involved for over a decade in the City Street Outreach Program in Toronto. Do you have a story to share? Do you know someone you think would be a great guest? Please go to SZF42.com. And for our American listeners, that's SZF42.com. Thank you for listening, and we hope to see you again.